When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Hot D, the House of the Dragon. My name's Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're back to do another Hot D preview. Aaron, I think this is the fourth preview we've done so far. And it looks like if the show keeps going the way it's going, we might do 100 of these. I don't know. There's a lot of speculation and news and stuff about release dates and all that. We don't have anything official yet, but we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a little bit of just the tiniest bit of casting news. That should be kind of fun. And then I want to tell people about a Twitter account that I found really cool. Okay. And I know you also have some stuff prepped over there. You did some actual reading to prep for this one.
Yeah, I went to because I saw. When we're looking at this Hot D episode, I'm like, oh man, we are in some content doldrums. I do not envy my brothers and sisters at winteriscoming.net that have to come up with daily posts of things to talk about because, They're wrapping up filming. We have no actual trailer, not an actual, 2 minute long trailer. We don't have a start date. There's not a lot of super exciting casting news, and if you want to ooh and ah over leaked photos and stuff like that, that's one thing. But so I'm like, boy, this is going to be a dry one. I'm going to have to consort to the original material. So I went and I read, and it's one of those things where it's like, I first thought it's like, okay, these are going to be my top five things Aaron's looking for in season one of House of the Dragon. And then I started, when I was writing down, I'm like, oh, this is going to turn a lot of people off because most people don't want spoilers. If like I, there's some epic fucking moments in this Fire and Blood novel. Some of them are full page illustrations of this crazy dragon shit that might happen at the climax of season one. But how happy would you be if, we were doing a putative Game of Thrones hype cast before it came out? And it's like top five things. At number one, the beheading of Ned Stark. Woo boy. You'd be pissed, right? So I'm confining my comments to what I think is going to be happening in the establishing moments of House of the Dragon. Like, we are going to come into the story and quickly be made to appreciate things like the fact that King Viserys dies to kind of kick things off. Like, that's stuff that everyone kind of knows. Just like same way, like if you said Jon Arryn dies in the first episode of Game of Thrones, that's not really a spoiler. So those are kind of things I dug through the first 20 pages, and I want to talk about some thematic stuff and some character based stuff and some basic conflicts that they're going to be setting up for us to enjoy in the hopefully in the first season.
All right. Well, where do you want to start? You want to start with some news?
I think we should start like the absolutely nothing spoiler. This is just casting news and gossip stuff. Let's start there.
All right. We start with casting for Ellen Baratheon has apparently been cast. Now, this is not official. This has not come from HBO or the production in any way, but it was found on her Spotlight page. I don't know if you're familiar with Spotlight, but Spotlight seems to be
sort of a movie profile. About Catholic priests molesting kids, right?
No, it's not about that. At least I hope not. Because Laura Lake has been cast and she has a Spotlight profile page. So I think it's just like, a place for actors to put their headshots and their qualifications and their work history and all that stuff. And I was checking her stuff out cause I was not familiar with the name Laura Lake, but apparently she is a serial televisionist. She has been in a lot of single episodes of a lot of different shows you might have heard of, like, I don't know, Pennyworth, Bridgerton, Britannia. Remember that the show with the governor from Walking Dead, David Morrissey?
Uh-huh.
That I guess has 3 seasons. It's kind of still going. It's on Epix.
Huh.
Yeah, and she was in an episode of that. She's been, everybody knows, has heard of Bridgerton, right?
Yeah.
Like romantic historical fiction stuff. I don't know. So she's been cast as Ellen Baratheon, who is one of 4 daughters, I think, of Boros Baratheon. Mm-hmm. Out there in, what is it, Storm's End? Is that the name of their castle?
Uh-huh.
And she's one, these 4 daughters collectively, I guess, are known as the 4 Storms. But when I heard that name, I was like, okay, cool. That sounds pretty badass. That sounds like she's going to be a pretty big player in this thing. And then I read a little bit further, and apparently she's got like a thing to do with the beginning of the series, probably, and a thing to do with the end, maybe. And that's kind of it. I was underwhelmed by like her role in all this. I was the same way,
because you hear the Force, because like I've read Fire and Blood, like it was something I did before season 8. You know, Anthony and I were promoting our Gods of Thrones books, and we were putatively going through this and reading it closely for hints about the final disposition of season 8 of Game of Thrones, which turned out to be a huge waste of time because the Double D's just did, as far as I can tell, whatever the fuck they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And didn't really care to pay off a lot of twists and turns that we were anticipating, but yeah, when I read that, I'm like, oh, the 4, because there's a bunch of color. I mean, this thing is filled of colorful people, like, you know, Boros Baratheon and Cregan Stark, and I hear the four storms, like, well, that sounds almost like a fucking X-Men team, you know. Mm-hmm. Like one of them can call forth light. But yeah, I started reading the backstory and I'm like, oh, this is a lot more Sand Snake, where the name sounds badass. The reality is, you know, like it's essentially some kind of dowry.
I was going to say her job is to be betrothed.
It's a bunch of marriage horse trading kind of stuff.
Which could be like interesting, you know, but
yeah. Yeah, this is kind of like finding out the casting of Myrcella Baratheon in season 1 of Game of Thrones.
Sure.
Like, yeah, it's a major character, but in the season 1, she's just going to be a little girl behind Cersei, and, you know, maybe she could be BFFs with Sans in another world, but...
Right. Yeah. It seems like Laura Lake is a little bit older than, you know, Myrcella would be. She plays, I guess, 21 to 26 somewhere. I looked through her spotlight page, and I was kind of encouraged by what I saw, because, like, A, she's British, so, you know, the accent is required, so I guess she'll nail that. She's got a lot of sports under her belt here, in which she's highly skilled, like archery, boxing, horse riding. That seems pretty necessary for this show. Martial arts, weaponry, medieval sword fighting.
All right.
Probably won't be shooting a lot of handguns or shotguns. Swimming, sword fighting.
Boros Baratheon is a famous inventor of Westeros. He essentially invents the blunderbuss.
Blunderbuss. It shoots vials of wildfire. She also has some precision driving experience, which probably won't be necessary either.
I want to see her back up a 6-horse carriage.
Yeah.
In traffic, do a one of those Rockford file turns with it. Pull the emergency brake. You know, it's funny because one of the points I'm going to make in my segment is George Martin clearly giving people adapting this work a lot of room to play around with this cast of characters and the, you know, historical train of events. So I wonder, like, if they, like, it does seem like she's got quite the blank canvas to paint the character onto, because she can do so many cool things. So I could see, I don't know, maybe they'll action her up and give her, there's tons of like hints and also the main account where they talk about like so many innumerable side struggles when you had this cataclysmic realm shattering fight between the ruling Targaryens up top. Like everybody's kind of scrambling for their piece and they're this and that. And I think it might be interesting to kind of, more flesh out some of these side characters who are just betrothal bait in the main, you know, historical sequence.
Yeah. No, I do hope there's something good in there. Like I said, I don't really know her as an actor. I haven't seen any of her work, but seems like she's prepped to go in there and really hit the ground running.
She could totally be betrothed. She's overqualified.
Sure.
Overqualified. Most people are. For betrothal.
Most people are. All right. I mean, we that's pretty much all the casting news I have that's even speculated at this point.
Yeah. Check out the previous three if you want to know the big stuff and what we think about it and how it fit in. We're down to the next will be the Milkmaids.
The only other arms. Thing that I like gleaned from my readings here is there's been this Twitter account whose name is @HouseTheDragons, which has been, it's a Spanish Twitter account that's been posting a lot of behind the scenes stuff, like shots inside of some of the castles over there, shots of exteriors where they're filming, and there was right, a really cool thing that they posted the other day, which I was excited about as like a tech nerd. They have created Dragonfire simulators, which is basically just this like, think of like a giant LED panel that hangs above the set. It's enormous. It like runs down a city street, essentially. Okay. Uh-huh. And they have like the LEDs timed to fire off as if a ball of fire was going through the sky. And nice. So it can light everything. It's a lot like, you know, what Disney's doing with the volume, except this is a lot simpler.
I was about to say, it's like a single purpose volume. It just simulates fireballs.
Which says something about what they're doing, right? Like, we're going to have so much fucking fire in this show that we need to build some special dedicated systems to handle it, to speed up the post-production.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing that gets your jaws kind of slavering, dripping saliva.
Yeah,
what that means is when you read the descriptions, because it, very early on in the account of the Dance of the Dragons and Fire and Blood, one of the characters, Prince Daemon, gives a like a rundown of the disposition of the dragon fleets.
Nice.
And it's like, you know, like we've got more, they've got more, or we've got more, but oh man, they've got the biggest, baddest one, and like they've got, and I'll be talking about that, but like, yeah. The thing about this that is a kind of like a high risk, high reward is there's no hiding the dragons and magic in the show. It's not like Game of Thrones where, yeah, you got some creepy ice zombies up front, but then you forget, like you are completely last. You're like everybody else in Westeros. Last thing you're thinking about is the fucking ice dragons, and they hit you with Dany's magical, you know, survival of the fire and the birth of the dragons. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like, you know, whole. You are not going to be eased into this. They have jumbo jet style dragons in both hangars of the Targaryen forces. So like,
yeah,
they're going to be dragons early and often. So they need to have economical and safe ways to put these CGI guys and CGI fire and still realistically. That's a really cool idea. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It probably speeds up post-production, which is something we probably ought to talk about. Cause you know, this thing is starting to get pushed back further and further. I know the official fan convention was postponed. Probably it was postponed once from January to February, and then I think it might be canceled indefinitely. Or
it's postponed indefinitely.
Postponed indefinitely. Yeah,
I'm sure they, you know, they're probably keeping an eye on these Omicron numbers.
For sure.
But yeah, that was like widely speculated that there was going to be a major trailer release.
Mm-hmm.
But I gotta say that like. I went into researching this update confident that we like kind of nervous that like we might get like a late April release.
Yeah.
But very confident that we'd get a June release. And as I did research and looking at the film, like the fact that they're still wrapping up filming.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of outlets like Esquire and Variety that are now starting to allude to a late 2022 or second half. So like, I mm-hmm. don't know, man, we might be looking at a fall or even winter release on this, depending on how the post-production goes.
It would be interesting to see this going head to head with the Rings of Power, right? Lord of the Rings stuff that Amazon is doing in September.
I mean, that's just stupid, right? If you hear like someone's got a blink, you can't run Lord of the Rings back to back with Hot D.
I don't know, man. Disney's doing it with all their shit, You know, they got a Marvel show and a Marvel movie.
Hot D versus Loader? Is that even going to work?
I don't know. I think fantasy fans would be in heaven.
Trying to move a Loader Hot D. Does anyone want to watch 2.5 hours of Dragon Shit each week? I don't know.
Yeah, a lot of people probably do. I don't know about 100 million of them, but enough of them. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. Because, like, you know, that only has 8 episodes or whatever, right? So that could run through October and then Hot D could drop. Yeah, they might be able to miss each other. Yeah. Or Hot D can come out early. We'll see.
They might be competitive. Also, it's like, I don't know, maybe they want to do a Highlander thing. They want to do a show off to see, you know, which fan base is more resilient. Who knows? I think that would be crazy to run.
Yeah.
You know, to be like running Invincible and The Boys at the same time, which would be super insane because that's all Amazon. But yeah, I think you would want to miss some of the, you know, like, don't run Picard against the Expanse. It's some common sense stuff like that.
Sure.
But the other thing is, like, you know, like, there's been, I think, 2 COVID delays already.
Yeah.
And I think things are, if I'm reading between the lines, things are a little bit more strict than the restrictions, the filming restrictions in the UK, which is where they're filming a lot of this stuff. So you got to get done the filming before you can get to post-production. And, you know, I know from talking to a lot of creative types that the post-production stuff can be just as affected by slowdowns and just people being out sick as anything else. So I no longer thinking we're going to get this in the spring or even late summer of 2022, but
yeah, we'll see. I doubt they give us
a trailer release.
I was going to say, I doubt they give us a release date even in that trailer. I bet we get trailer 1 without a release date or with a, like, late 2022.
So you think they're going to have, because we've gotten the teaser, you think they'll go teaser, trailer 1, trailer, because I thought they might just do full trailer and
maybe. I don't know. The pattern I've seen from shows lately has been teaser, maybe even a couple teasers, and then trailer 1, trailer 2, then release.
Yeah, I gotta see if we're getting a trailer 1, trailer 2. Trailer 1's got to have something like fall 2022,
exactly. Yeah,
or winter 2022.
Like a general time.
Like, yeah, you can't just be like 2022 in the first trailer,
right? What if it's 2023?
My God. Well, it certainly changed our allocation of time. And so, yeah, because that's the thing. Like, I was just talking to we were talking shop with somebody over the weekend, and we were commiserating over the fact that, like, other than Lord of the Rings, which, are we sure that the September time is like, you know, like,
I think that's
so far away.
Date.
It feels like something that's made the slip, right?
Right,
like,
right.
I have zero information over anything that I'm excited to come back. You know, I don't know when Hot D's happening. I don't know when Better Call Saul's coming back. I don't know when the next season of Boys is dropping. I don't know when For All Mankind, like, everything is still up in the air. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
The Valve Studios, it's done when it's done philosophy, I guess.
I like it.
Yeah, I guess it just makes our lives hell to try to, like, you know, plan vacations and advertising and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
All right. Well, I think that's it for casting and basic news and updates where we're at. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with what we'll call highlights from the early goings of House of the Dragon.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, Jim, as I alluded to, I cracked open my copy of Fire and Blood, and I read about the 50 pages with a highlighter, and I'll probably be talking about the first 10 to 15 pages or so, which just it's covered the first two or three days of the time period known as the Dance of the Dragons, or kind of kicks off the immediate aftermath of King Viserys dying. And there's a lot of things, because like the first time I read this, like I said, I was just kind of trying to read through and find hints of things that would be interesting to talk about in terms of like prophetic fulfillment or, essentially trying to find interesting things to talk about Game of Thrones. Now I was just looking at the narrative and there's a couple things I immediately struck me. Is number one, the amount of room, like the first page or two of this account is, it feels like George Martin giving everyone every possible excuse to ignore or riff on or change the history that he's about to lay down. Because he says things like, you know, he has different sources, like there's a Septon Eustace, who is this kind of like staid conservative fellow that offers a particular account. And then there's this fool Mushroom, this dwarf jester character that usually has like a extremely lurid, bloody, or sexified take. And then there's also this Grand Maester Munkin that compiled this The Dance of Dragons, a true telling. And he's kind of like what I think comes closest to like the authoritative voice in this historical account. But if you, but then you look at the paragraph where he's talking about how much he likes Grandmaster Munkin, they then have this caveat, though Munkin's exhaustive history was not written until a generation later. So you already have like no kind of firsthand accounts, and drew on many different sorts of materials, including Maester's chronicles, memoirs, Stewart's records, interviews with over 147 surviving witnesses, blah, blah, blah. There's all this kind of like equivocating over whether you're getting the true story or not. And sometimes you'll get three or four different versions of a scene. And I think it'll be really fun to like early on. I'm going to be looking as a game as a George Martin fan of like which way the show seems to be leading. Are they leading more? I'm going to call this like Septon Eustace, like the fucking nerd, the virtuous nerd, or are they going to lean Mushroom, which is the, you know, extremely inappropriate dwarf character?
I'm getting a real like epistles kind of vibe to this, like the you know the Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the whole section of the Bible that deals with like the death of Jesus. I'm getting that vibe from this whole thing.
Yeah, there's different flavors of what you can consider canon in this, like like the different levels of canon. There's also a lot of, because like a lot of times, like, you know, this is a pretty straightforward account because it reads like an encyclopedia or a history book. But one of those that tries to cite different sources and be like, well, it could be this, it could be this, but it's probably this. They talk about like, because this is like a realm shattering event, you know. You've got the ruling clan that just 100 years ago took over and united these seven kingdoms. Hasn't actually, I don't think, been fully united yet. I don't think they've brought they've managed to bring Dorne into the fold yet. So it's all a very new thing, and they're having a civil war. The only way these people had to control us was their fucking dragons. We kind of secretly hate them, and now they're having a civil war. Fire and Blood points out that amidst the chaos and carnage brought on by their rivalry, other would-be kings would stake claims as well, strutting about like mummers on a stage for a fortnight or a moon's turn, only to fall as swiftly as they had arisen. I think that's interesting because it's like it leaves room for tons and tons of intrigue. That it's not just the two, you know, the greens and the blacks, the, you know, the supporters of Queen Alicent Hightower versus Princess Rhaenyra. It's all this stuff in the middle. They also say in the next paragraph, this was a war marked by stealth, murder, betrayal as well. A war fought in shadows and stairwells, council chambers and castle yards, with knives and lies and poison.
Latrines and outhouses.
Right. To me, this is Martin looking right at the reader and be like, I know this is called Dance of Dragons and about the Targaryens at their height fighting tooth and nail to dragons, but there's also all that good Game of Thrones shit in there too.
Yeah, totally.
You're still going to have your Master of Whispers, and you're still going to have your spies and your skullduggery and all that kind of stuff.
Good, because that's what I come to these shows for, honestly.
And it starts off early, like in his account of King Viserys dying. You know, he talks about like the body was discovered in the hour of the bat in the middle of the night. When it was the king's custom to take a cup of hippocras, which is sounds like Martin's timey, you know, kind of like, you know, whatever, some kind of physician drink. But like the dwarf Mushroom comes in here and says that he thinks Queen Alicent hurried King Viserys on his way with a pinch of poison in his hippocras cup. But then it's noted that King Mushroom wasn't actually at King's Landing. He was at Dragonstone with the rival queen, Princess Rhaenyra. So it's kind of like, not only was he not there and maybe he's prone to making shit up, but also he's got a vested interest in the other side because he was working for him. But I'm wondering, like, you know, is this the, I've always thought of like this being the John Arryn event. And similarly, there was a question about, did he die of natural causes? Was he poisoned? You know, there's kind of a mystery. I wonder if we're going to see like this kind of mystery being explored in real time in the books. But again, this is stuff that just happens like right off the bat. The other interesting thing is something that me and Anthony talked about is like, who does Martin think is the good guys and the bad guys, right? Like, does he try to keep like a straight down the middle, like, you know, is he on the side of the blacks or the greens in this fight? And I gotta say, as I'm reading this, it seems like he's solidly on team black. Like almost all the accounts say that the, you know, the Princess Rhaenyra is the rightful claim, and like the High Towers are kind of they're like very ambitious and they do a lot of dastardly things. Like, for example, and I think naturally you're sympathetic. So you got the Princess Rhaenyra. She is on Dragonstone in the middle of childbirth. She's got six children. This is her seventh, and it's a difficult childbirth. She's been in labor for 3 days. Her father dies early in this process, and everyone closes ranks around it. Like, the queen has all of his manservants thrown in through the black tower, the black cells, because she doesn't want this getting out. And she calls the high council together, and she eliminates anyone that like is not on board with putting her firstborn son on the throne and denying Princess Rhaenyra her claim.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this political, but like, this is all like parallel to Princess Rhaenyra fighting for her life in trying to give birth to her child. So I feel like naturally you're more sympathetic to her.
I would think so. Is there a reason like why she doesn't want that information getting out?
Because she's trying to steal the throne. So like,
yeah, but how would that
24
help?
years before this, Viserys, while he still had, you know, his queen, there's this question about which of his children should be the one that's going to succeed him. You know, do you go,
sure,
you know, can it follow the female line? Does it have to follow the male? And he decreed that, like, I want my daughter to sit the throne.
Uh-huh.
But the book makes a point out that, like, a lot of the lords that swore those oaths were like children or teenagers, and a lot of them that were kind of like would be to support him this 24 years, like those men are dead or old, and they don't have. So like,
mm-hmm.
Otto Hightower, who's the hand of the king, and his daughter that's the queen, sees this unique opportunity to like essentially steal the kingdom back from the Targaryens.
Sure.
You know, like, or at least like our good, like, Andal Targaryen children will sit on the throne. So I think that's what the and so she doesn't want this getting out, because if they did the proper procedures of just ringing the bells and sending out the crows, the princess's people could get prepared for taking over the throne. So she's got like a several day head start. And there's like,
the element of surprise.
There's like these really grody details where time is tracked by how much the king's body is stinking in his quarters.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, because like, they're like, the Sisters of Silence and the Septons have not have been there to clean his body or anything. He's just festering. And it's like, you know, the body can be smelled in the king's chambers. The body can be, all of Maegor's fast is now stinking. And it's like, there's like this clock of this putrefying corpse that's happening, which I'm pretty sure will be a plot point.
I would hope so.
But yeah, and there's like, so I'm excited about that. There's also some drama about like which of the king's council is going to support this obvious takeover of the throne.
Yeah.
And you got like, you know, war between the younger, ambitious people who see a chance to advance versus the old guard who remembered their vows. You've got some treachery. There's a really cool account where there's two king's guard that are guarding the princess in their childbirth. And there's the other five, including the Lord Commander, that are going to support the Queen Alicent. And there's a story of one of those five defecting in the first day and stealing the king. So like the queen wanted to have this complete victory where before Princess Rhaenyra even knows what the hell's going on, she has got all of the King's Landing united behind her son, King Aegon II's rule. She's got the official crown on his head. She's got the High Septon coming in to give him the blessing, and like it's essentially accomplished. Like everything's done before the Team Black even has a chance to tie up their sneakers. And there's all this series of things that go wrong. Like one of the Kingsguard defects, and now it's Queen Rhaenyrus that has the official crown on her head, and she's looking more official. The High Septon, who's old, got sick, and he can't travel from Old Town. So like, a lot of these like big planned coronation like just got nipped in the bud because of circumstance. And I think that's going to be cool too. There's also this like the first person that dies on the King's Council for not going on. There's like three different proposed deaths. Like he got put in the black cells and essentially starved to death. the Lord Commander slitting his throat as soon as he spoke, and then the Lord Commander throwing him out the highest tower window. And it's like, again, are we going to Septon Eustace's depiction, or are we going to roll with Mushroom on this one?
I was going to say that first one with the poison seems like it could be something that's debated, whereas that one seems like you're going to see one point of view is absolutely true.
Yeah. There's also just like fascinating, like debates about like, who do we think will support us? And this is where, again, I think, Team Green is coded for evil, because a lot of like the Lannister allies, you know, kind of line up behind them. You know, a lot of the people in, Highgarden and, those types are backing them. But then you look at the list of the allies of, the team Black, Princess Rhaenyra's. It's, you know, the Starks in Winterfell. There's this badass named Cregan that's ruling up there. The Manderleys of White Harbor, another, you know, famous Stark bannerman. And then they mentioned that, like, House Arryn is kind of up in the air. They seem to be always the wild card, but they're worried because the current ruler of the Eyrie is a woman, and the Greens are worried that she's not going to support them, because if they support essentially overthrowing the female succession, then that will mean that she could lose her position in the Eyrie too. So she's going to, for purely political purposes, back the queen, Princess Rhaenyra's, because she wants women to be able to hear it, you know?
Sure.
That's kind of a cool, I think, a political angle that they do. The other cool thing is, I think, is going to be meeting the dragons, because you've got, like I said, this Prince Daemon gives this kind of rundown of all the dragon fleets that the Greens and Blacks have. And the Greens only have four dragons, but their biggest one is this Vhagar, which is like the second largest dragon that the original, you know, the prince or the King Aegon brought over from old Valyria. Like, these are like the original dragon. There's only one of them left, and it's just this big, like, jumbo jet style dragon. But all their other dragons are kind of young, and their dragon riders are inexperienced.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Team Black, you know, who has their primary has Dragonstone, that's where all the dragons kind of hang out that are not like the personal, you know, rides of the kings and whatnot. And they have a lot more of them. So they have like 8 to 10 dragon riders, which is another limiting factor, because if you got dragons but no one to ride them, which is it seems like it's partially through the like Targaryen blood, they, you know, kind of like that. You have to have like, not everyone can ride a dragon. You have to have a particular either genetic disposition or affinity, because they give these kids these eggs at birth, you know, like they put them in their crib, and it's kind of like the eggs hatch and like they bind to this, and like it's usually kind of like, you know, during a person's life, you will only ride the one dragon, you know?
So what happens with the dragons that outlive their riders?
They can get, it depends, because like dragons get old, like as they get older and crankier, they're less and less likely to tolerate some new person. Like Valerian, the Black Dread, he was the big dragon to Aegon, rode. Like in his later years, he just preferred to like sleep in the dragon pit, and like if you tried to rouse him, it was your ass. And there's like one like great granddaughter of Aegon that for whatever reason Valyrian kind of like tolerated her riding him, and there's like a whole fucking disaster about that story ends up with. And I'm almost wondering like how much will they be tempted to go back and tell some of these like great Targaryen stories, like will we have some flashbacks of the days of Aegon and whatnot. So yeah, like the older and crankier a dragon gets, the harder it is to kind of bend them to your will. Whereas if they're younger and, you know, the dragon rider dies, you can replace them with another dragon rider. But they talk about like, okay, we've got these 8 dragons and dragon riders. We got these other 3 dragons that are in reserve. They haven't, like the silver wing that hasn't been ridden since my granddaddy, but like he'd probably take him. And then they talk about, behind the mountain dwelled 3 wild dragons, never claimed nor ridden by any man, living or dead. The small folk had named them Sheep Stealer, Grey Ghost, and the Cannibal.
Oh, boy.
And if I were to tell you that each one of these dragons has a pretty epic story of their breaking in this tome, I would not be telling a lie. And I'm very curious to see how, because that's the other thing is like when the if these dragons were ever to be used, it implies a certain level of desperation on the fact that the Targaryens, they've done lost all their best dragon bets and they're down to Sheep Stealer and the Cannibal that have never been ridden before. And who the fuck do they get to ride these? How do you determine who is a dragon rider and who is not in a given populace? Do you conscript them and just throw them on the back and see what sticks?
You just measure their medieval Chlorian account.
Twer it so simple, because it turns out there's a lot of just hard medieval dragon science that has to be learned in the terms of this. The other thing that's really interesting is, like, so Martin, I think, is firmly behind Team Black, but he offers a situation where, like, by the time Team Black realizes that King is dead and they need to go into action, Queen Alicent and her father, Otto Hightower, have essentially put King's Landing under their iron grip, and they've gotten more than half the realm to kind of already bend the knee. And the Blacks get this terms offered, and they said that the terms were that King offered was generous, you know, like essentially confirming, like, you get to keep Dragonstone. All of your sons will be given great holdings and lands and prime places. You just don't get to rule no more. And the queen has to sit there and, like, you know, is it worth making the realm bleed for this? And I think the one time that Martin's a little judgy is, like, I think a better person would have been like, you know what? Fuck it. These Andals have always not, like, you know, they're this is their way of kind of breaking and tempering us. And maybe, but she just cannot consonance this affront to the Targaryen lineage and her particular promise that was made to her by her father. And she's a very, and sure, the whole realm is going to burn and bleed. They lead this account off with the maester who's telling the story. They said that, you know, he calls the Dance of Dragons is a very fanciful name for something that would be more apt to be called the Dying of the Dragons, because the Targaryens never recover from this. Like, this kills the majority of their dragons, their dragon riders. It starts the spiral of their decline, which leads 200 years later to Robert's Rebellion, putting them out for good.
Yeah.
But the final thing I want to talk about, and this is thing that I think we've talked about in previous previews, the fact that there is the Sir Cargills, or maybe it's Cargyle. There's two twins, Arik and Eric.
Sure. Not confusing in any way.
But they set these up. These are like the anti or bizarro Hound in the Mountain.
Okay.
These are brothers that love each other very much, and they've been inseparable their whole life, and they both pledged service to the king, and now they are divided because one thinks that King Aegon has a better claim and one thinks Princess Rhaenyra's. And there's this, they allude to it. They don't talk about it, but they said long after the dance was done, the singer Lucian of Tarth would compose a sad ballad called Farewell, My Brother, that's still sung today. And it outlines the final night that the brothers, before they withdraw as enemies, like try to spend it like convincing each other of which one is right. And then when they realized they couldn't, they pledged their love to each other and like kissed each other goodbye and knew that the next time they met, it was going to be as mortal enemies. Mm-hmm. Man, it's a really good tale. And I'd like who they've cast. I think this is going to be one of the key points of interest.
Yeah.
Because these are guys that, like, they don't really have anything to gain or benefit or lose, because they can't hold lands and titles. This is purely a matter of honor, and it's dividing this particular family like it is the realm. I think it's going to be one of the standout stories to look forward to.
Sure. That sounds good to me.
And I think I got to stop there, because, like I said, I think this is all plausible episode 1-2 stuff. Anything else would be to be more spoilery. And I guess if we have another update where we don't have a ton of like actual update, I don't think that'll be the case, because in fact, we talked about doing an emergency one, like regardless of where Anthony is in his season, if they drop another trailer for Hot D, we're going to be on there to talk about it.
Yeah, I think we should.
But if we have another slow point, I might go in, like, because there's tons and tons of information about like, what was Otto Hightower like? How did he become into the service of King Viserys? You know, what is his daughter like? What was Princess Rhaenyra's like before, you know, like what were her good qualities? You know, why did her father invest her into the queenship when she was so young, and how have things changed in the last 24 years? stuff that's kind of like set up that it does seem like they're going to get into, because they've cast young versions of like all these different, you know, queens and princesses. So they can have like flashbacks to show how these, you know, relationships evolved and eroded over the years. But I think that stuff would be some good fodder to kind of the dovetail into. Because, yeah, I can't. I mean, I could tell you what's probably going to happen in the first season, but do you really want me to?
No, of course not.
So, anyway, I'm starting a process of boning back up on my Westerosi history. It's a long and arduous process, because this was all 200 year history back when, you know, Game of Thrones was a thing. So,
yeah, I mean, you didn't need a lot of this background for Game of Thrones, and I imagine, you know, you're not going to need a ton of setup for this new series either. They'll tell you everything you need to know. And you already have so many of the concepts, right? Like, I know what a Targaryen is. I know a lot about dragons and dragon riding and stuff. Like, a lot of the heavy lifting that Game of Thrones had to do later in its run, it has been set up for this show in a weird way.
And it's also kind of like, I think, something, if you do like the dragon action, it reminds me of George Lucas. One of his pitches for the prequels is you never, when it comes to lightsaber combat, you only saw someone that's crippled and lost half of their body function because they're machine now, an old man and an untrained boy fight.
Yeah.
Like, you're now going to see Jedi at the height of their powers. The same thing about the Targaryens. Like, Dany literally learned how to swing her leg over like 2 months before the main dragon action began. Jon Snow didn't even have that. You're now going to see like people who are skilled at flying, are practiced and have bonded with the dragons their entire lives, get up to some crazy ass dragon combat. And I think, I mean, it's one of those things where it could, like, it's like if I told you you're going to watch a movie about a giant robot punching a giant monster, like, there's cool ways you can do that.
Sure.
And there's dumb ways you can do that. I hope that we get the cool version.
I'm hoping it's like
all that stuff could be silly.
I want it to be like a really good, you know, Top Gun style jet combat movie, right? Like dogfighting.
Yeah.
Those kinds of movies can really get me going. And I understand like the tactics they're employing and stuff. It's not just, you know, they're flying at each other, they're shooting fire and they're veering off. It's like, they're trying to gain an advantage through positioning and stuff. And that's the kind of stuff I want to see with dragons.
There's lots of like, you know, night flying and storm flying. And I think done well, you'll get that. And that's also like the climax of battle. Like, you know, these are also like the air war, you know, it's like, it's not going to win the campaign, but like, you have to do it before, you know, you can't invade a castle while there's still dragons in the air. Right.
Sure.
So there's also like they're like the exclamation points on big pivotal battles already. So I think there'll be, it's like, imagine if the Battle of the Blackwater, you know, like its climax was instead of the wildfire, it was literal dragons strafing castles and stuff. It'd be that much more exciting, right?
Sure.
So like, I think the potential of these battles to be bigger and better is going to be awesome. But also, this book again portends a lot of backdoor negotiation and skullduggery and treachery and spycraft and intelligence and poisons, and it's not all going to be the dragons, but they're going to be a lot of dragons.
All right, well, I'm in for all that. I'm excited about all
of it. We'll be back in like two months or so for another Hot D update, unless the trailer drops, in which we will come to talk about our impressions about that. If there's, you know, and as soon as we get information on when this thing is actually going to land, whether the Hot D is going to go head to head against the loader, we're going to have to see. Thanks for checking in with the House of the Dragon with us. We're going to flip the keys back to Anthony. And we hope to see you back real soon. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.